Hey everybody, just Dave and I, Shop Talk Show number 276. We're going to get into a little discussion about web components and the fascinating world around that. We're going to talk about a project gone wrong. We're going to talk about how you might go about teaching JavaScript from the very beginning, from the foundation up, from somebody who's interested in doing that. We're going to talk about what to do when somebody steals your code. That and more coming up on Shop Talk Show. This episode is brought to you by Rollbar. That's rollbar.com. Full stack error monitoring for your web apps. We'll tell you more about that later in the show. For now, Dave, please kick things off.
Shopper Maniacs, you're listening to a hard stop edition of the Shop Talk Show. I'm Dave Reber, with me is Chris Coyer. We got hard stop, Chris. We got meetings.
Yeah, you know, that's how life is sometimes. A lot of people got meetings. Dave's a busy man. I'm a busy man. Busy people here. No, just kidding. A full episode here, of course. So I have some stuff I wanted to talk to you about, because it's been, I'd say it's been 3-4 weeks in a row where Dave slips in some kind of mention about web components.
I'm little fascinated with
dream. Little fascinated with them, and they to me it's felt like a roller coaster of a concept, in that it's sometimes it's hot. This is the future of building for the web. And sometimes it's a little cold, I feel like. That's the roller coaster it's gone along. Anyway, before I go, tell me why you're so excited, maybe, and then I'll respond.
Oh, you could just destroy me online here. Okay. So here's my pitch for web components. React, I think React and web components are trying to solve, and even like atomic CSS or atomic design, I guess more Brad Frost concept than the like utility class concept. I think they're all trying to solve the same problem, which is dependable reusable modules. So if I can switch out module A and put in module B,
no side effects,
with like minimal in theory you're just passing props to this one, and all it's so encapsulated, it just wants some props. It's got all its CSS, it's got all its JSS or JS, it's got all its JS, and it's just encapsulated enough. So as long as it's fed the right data, it's a happy camper. React has taken the approach, because that's kind of pre-web components, or the web component spec was starting to form, but it was kind of first to market. I mean, like jQuery plugins and Dojo plugins were kind of the first to market on these sort of like client side objects. So React just has a very good component module. I think anyone who uses it loves these.
Kind of like the only way to use it. It's like, that's how you use it.
Yeah.
You build a component and then you use it.
And it has a very good state thing bundled with it. You know, it's like, I update the state, the global state object, or the like component state object, and the whole app kind of just says, yeah, I'll change myself based on that. So like all that, you know, if you were to write that in jQuery, it's like thousands of lines of jQuery. It's pretty brutal. Kind of looks gnarly and ugly too. Web components is doing the same job, but it's more from an HTML angle. Like, you import this HTML file and it will sort of like React, you pass props into it and it can render based on the properties it has. And if you change the properties, you can kind of tell it to, you have to kind of do all the code, but if you change the properties, it'll change the way it's rendered.
Mm-hmm. So in React, if I make a component, I might call it, I don't know, nav or something. And then like the convention is that it's an angle bracket and then a capital N, A, V. Mm-hmm. And then maybe I'll pass it like style dark or something. Like just, I don't know. You can pass it anything you want. They look like attributes in HTML, but those are props. And I'm passing that component, that data. That data could be anything. Mm-hmm. Okay. So in a web component, I also can make a weirdly named HTML tag, right? I can also make a nav element, and nav's a bad example because nav already exists as an HTML element, but I can invent a new one if I want.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Right? I can call it Dave Nav, and it's created. So that's one thing that a web component is custom elements, they're called, right? Invented names of elements.
Yeah.
But there's more to it. That's just one thing that a web component is. It's actually more things than that, right? Another one of those things is, not only can I invent this new element and pass it props and stuff, it can have its own like sandboxed world in which you control what's allowed to come out and come in. Just really the main important thing there is CSS.
Mm-hmm.
So I can say whatever styling I do inside of this thing, it does not leak out to the parent page.
Yeah.
Does not leak out. And that's a thing called the shadow DOM.
Shadow DOM.
And shadow DOM is, it can be used together with a custom element. So I can make Dave Nav. Dave Nav says links inside of me are red. And that doesn't make any links anywhere outside of Dave Nav red. That's totally isolated inside of it. What's a little weird about that is that styles can leak in.
Well, not like in, I think, web components, the like true spec, no, but with the like polyfill, yes, they will leak in.
I thought it was the exact opposite of that, but I might be wrong.
I'm not confident either, but in theory, it's an encapsulated deal.
Right. And there's a way to handle this. So like styles that leak in, and I have a little demo, so I know that it's doing it to some degree without using Polymer, which is weird. Well, let's like Polymer is like a different conversation almost, because I think it confuses things. You can set, hey, on this root of this custom element, all initial, and it'll make sure that no styles leak in, or any styles do leak in, but all initial says, yeah, it just says anything that, you know, normally would cascade in here, just go back to your initial value, and please don't do that instead. So it's a pretty easy fix indeed. So that's pretty cool. I don't actually know the answer of the JavaScript encapsulation. Like, so when you do the shadow DOM thing, it's basically like you're taking a string of HTML, and that string includes a style block. That string includes all the HTML that's inside of it. And that string, I presumably can have a script block inside of it too. And I don't totally understand the shadow DOM boundary and scripts. Like, I doubt the inside can reach outside, but I know that you do have a choice whether the outside can reach inside. That's a true false thing that you set up when you declare the shadow DOM. Like, is this accessible from the outside or not?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's called piercing the shadow DOM.
Cool word.
Which is such a, so freaking D&D. It's epic. yeah, you know, again, this is kind of like, for me, I think you can, like, you know, your header can affect, you know, your something else. I don't know, your login form. I'm trying to think of like an example.
You have to code it up to do it in a way.
But, yeah, and it can respond to events, like global events, like if it hears a trigger or something like that. But what's nice about it is the, you know, the JavaScript inside the element, or the shadow DOM, the shadow element, when I add a click handler or whatever to the A tag, it's all inside that A tag.
So, okay, so it is scoped in that way, which is pretty darn cool as well.
I believe so, because you do everything kind of through you're not like, you're doing everything through that basically DOM node. It's almost like an iframe, but you're doing everything through that thing. So you'd just say whatever.
So we've mentioned at least two things here: the shadow DOM, vital to this. And the custom elements, which is cool because it's a developer convenience and you name things how you want to name them and it makes sense that way. It's kind of a convention that's happened. And then there's HTML imports, which are part of this story. And I think it's like, you know, remember I said it's the shadow DOM is like a big string and then you say, here, set the shadow DOM for this is this, blah. Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of where you could use an HTML import to like make that part a little easier. Like an HTML import is like a list of the scripts and styles and stuff that get injected in there. It's just a, yet another convenience thing. And I think there's a fourth thing. I can't remember what it is. It's not like we did like 1,000 miles of research for this. Sorry to put you on the spot with all this web component stuff. But part of the beauty of this is it requires no build tool or nothing. This is all like native browser stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So the web components .org, the web components spec, I mean, it's the it's like the four specifications, custom elements we talked about, whatever I want to name my thing, the shadow DOM, and HTML template, which is that template element which exists, and that's kind of, it's basically like a, it's like a script tag that you can put HTML in. If that helps you, like it's basically like, don't render this, but it's HTML inside of here. And then the HTML imports, which is where you're like link rel my thing.
Yeah, it's like the worst named thing ever because it's not, you can't HTML import like H1 tags.
Right.
You're only importing scripts and styles, I'm pretty sure.
Well, it'd be like the, you're basically import the component itself. And that's, this is the one that's maybe took the wind out of the sails because Firefox was like, yeah, we don't know if we're doing that part of this HTML spec. So like the whole like link rel import, they said, yeah, we're not maybe going to do that. So, but I think they may be changing their tune on it.
Yeah. It looks like a lot of browsers are. I mean, Safari says it's on hold. Yeah. Edge is still thinking about it. So yeah, imports is that, I guess that's the most controversial of all of
because
them.
It does add like a, you know, it's, you know, there's the new JavaScript modules specification 2, which is kind of loosely connected. Like, how do you get one file to request another file to request 10 files without creating a botnet or like, you know, just overly like just wearing down a browser.
So. Yeah, and this world of ES6 imports probably factors in here somewhere too. It's all very complicated, but I can see how it appeals to you because of this, you know, the no build process kind of thing. And I think that's it's so raw. It's cool in that way.
That's what my ethos is. And you know, I code this thing and it's done. It's ready. There is like a concept with Polymer and with, you know, web components of vulcanizing. Basically you're just like you would with Webpack or something. You have your router, which has some route views, your router component, and it has some views kind of specified there. Let's say your blog post list and your article page and your, I'm trying to think of like components, your comment component, your header component, your footer component. And
photo.
And whatever. You probably want like most of your pages in the template to have the header component, sort of your app shell, I believe is what Google is calling it. You want that to kind of be on every page. You don't want it to have to like pause rendering to go fetch that first component. So you want that to kind of, you want some things to be vulcanized or kind of injected into the view, you know. So your page is going to ship with a Dave header element or Dave nav element. But it's going to have some kind of inline script or something inside there to kind of make it register and run and et cetera. So there's a little bit of a build process you can inject, but you don't have to. So
yeah, which is part of Polymer. Polymer started life as like a polyfill for all this stuff, and they definitely have separated themselves from that. Like there are polyfills for all of the web component stuff, and that's not Polymer. Polymer is like a anymore. It's like a helper library for that. It kind of reminds me of Vue files, like .vuer. You put all the stuff in one file, the template, the style, and the script, and then it's automatically a custom element. It's pretty sweet.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. So you start building out. I have like half a blog post written about this, but
does it make this even more complicated before does it do the, like, if I change a prop, please re-render my template? I should tell you that React says, hey, you want to use web components? Fine. Web components are compatible with the idea of React. All React does is the re-rendering of the DOM on state changes. So it makes perfect sense to use React and web components together. They're not competitors. What about that? Does Polymer help with the React-y stuff?
It does not, but they're not incongruous. There is a video from Polycast, Rob Dodson, who's been on the show, how to use Redux in Polymer. I can put a link to that.
So you could have an app that uses web components, Polymer, and React and Redux.
Yeah, basically. And I'm trying to think of what the code ends up looking like. I don't know if he has a demo here. Let's see. Yep, it's GitHub Polymer Redux.
Wow.
Or there's a...
Or maybe it's not React. Maybe it's just the Redux part. Because Redux, remember, to the world out there, is a way to really globalize your state. And so that all state changes go through Redux, and Redux kind of sprinkles it the rest of your app. So it's kind of a way that React is very... It deals with state for you, but it just handles state. It doesn't mandate how you handle state. And React is very... Or Redux is very opinionated about state in a way that a lot of developers resonate with. They're like, yeah, please help me rein this state in.
Yeah, you basically fire in a... Or throw some data... Or I guess it's fire an event and pass data to the state manager, and the state manager says, okay, this actually works. Now I'm going to go notify people that this has changed.
Right. Like global pub sub, I guess.
Yeah. So it's basically you get a thing called connected callback. That's like the default, or is that a new method? There's in React components, there's like a life cycle, you know, component did update, component will mount, component did mount, or something like that. Like web components have a similar kind of life cycle. It's like dispatch callback and attached callback or something like it. Mm-hmm. You know, that's basically like component did mount or something. Man, I don't know if I was totally ready to talk about all this, but so you can do kind of Redux inside of there and then have it kind of respond on the callback. The thing with web components is you don't have you'll start using it and you realize the first thing you need is a template language. You want if statements. So if this property exists, render this. Like if there's a price, spit out a price. But native web components does not have this. Or you want a for loop. So for all the posts in posts, spit out this post, you know, slat, like whatever you're calling it, like a link to a post or a post.
Right. Web components doesn't have that, but ES6 does. Yeah. Right.
Well, web components. Yeah. You could code it, but you're going to have to do a lot of like string replacement. Basically, like you're going to have to like grab a, or like you maybe inject another component that passes the data that spits it out. But Polymer has this functionality inside of it. So it has like a DOM repeat and a DOM if custom element that you basically can use like if statements and repeat statements. So that's like another killer feature of Polymer.
It's so funny that if you go Polymer though, it's like it's so related to web components and it like follows that ethos kind of, but it's like it's not, it, don't think of it as a polyfill. If you go Polymer, you've gone Polymer. You're Polymer forever.
You got a framework. You're now a frameworker.
Right. Does that make it appeal to you less, or are you still like, no, this is still cool?
That makes it appeal to me less, but it does. The Polymer is, like you said, it's very true to what web components look like and feel like native web components. But web components were also designed to be super low level. So there's another library called Skate.js, and I forget who's building that, but it's some big brand name. But Skate.js is kind of just a JavaScript API to create web components and inject them in. So it's just like React, but you're creating like native components that the browser can then kind of like use all its browser powers to manage and update. So I'm kind of deep here. But
I think we covered it pretty good. Yeah. I just did a post recently about Shadow DOM. Like, you can pick and choose this stuff a little bit. I think just the Shadow DOM on a div is interesting and compelling in a way.
Yeah. I mean, if you can do the encapsulation, like specifically of styles, I think it changes a lot of things. The things I've gotten into with web components and just kind of doing Shadow DOM-y stuff, things we use to manage CSS complexity and all that, like BEM or whatever, they kind of go away, Chris. Like, I'm not shitting on BEM here. It's great, but you know, you don't need to namespace anything. Your base element, base in BEM is host. So you just have host.
Right. Your colon host.
Yeah, your modifier is an attribute. So like, you know, like it's, you know, host or whatever, a type fancy or whatever you want to call it. Like your modifier is an attribute, not like a dash dash thing. Your element.
And think of all the other projects out there that are doing this. CSS modules is doing, you know, we talked about this not so long ago. There's a million projects out there trying to tackle this scoping of styles thing, including Atomic CSS, and it's like the hot thing right now is, I don't want to name things anymore so much, and I don't want global CSS anymore, and I want encapsulated things that I can chuck around my app and just feel confident and strong about and stuff. And there's so much of it that it like can't be ignored in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think it really kind of Atomic CSS and stuff like that. I think people are using it, you know, for a lot of different reasons, but I think they're just using it to say like, I want this thing to look like this. And I think web components gives you that. Like it says, no, this little component, I want it to look like this. But you could be in a situation where if you change margins everywhere, you have to like update a bunch of different things. But like you're saying, I want it to look like this. And all the styles for this thing are right here. Just like in, you know, Atomic, you know, inline or multi-class utility CSS. So I think it has a lot of things. And here's kind of my other thing. You want my final kind of zinger here?
Yes.
If you're one of those people who hates React illogically, but if you're one of those people who hates like big JavaScript or big frameworks or stuff, something like that, I think it's really important that you get behind web components, because that's the alternative. I was at a meetup recently and, you know, somebody was asking me what I do. And I was like, you know, I kind of do like pattern systems and kind of component systems for large companies. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And he was like, oh, you know, like React. And I go, yeah, React. But, you know, I can do that, but I kind of am leaning more towards web components. And his response, and this is an educated person that just was like, well, React kind of already won that battle, you know, and just kind of saying like React cracked that nut in terms of like component, you know, front end components. And so that's a lot of people. A lot of people think, you know, just use React.
They do. But look at, you know, isn't another thing that's kind of in the zeitgeist right now is the like looking back almost fondly on jQuery and saying, look at how influential it was on JavaScript and how we don't need it anymore because of how influential it was on JavaScript. And now we're back home at native JavaScript. And like, that's so great. And maybe there's even more we can learn from it, but certainly we'll be learning from other libraries as well. It seems like there's a circle of life kind of thing that happens and that there is a future probably as big and powerful as React is today, although it has more competitors than jQuery did probably. Like big ones, you know, I know there was certainly jQuery competitors with whatever, Dojo and Prototype and Mood Tools and all that stuff. But but the competitors seem like bigger for React, with, you know, Angular's so huge and there's just a lot more that it, eventually there'll be a homecoming, don't you think? That, you know, JavaScript is evolving faster than it ever has. At least it seems like it has. And that certainly some of these things will kind of come back to native JavaScript land, and there'll be a little bit of an exodus from the big libraries and stuff. And that certainly web components is just like sitting here waiting for people. It seems like for sure that's going
to
happen.
Yeah, I think there needs to be a big company besides Google or whoever who's using web components. I know there probably are. Like, McDonald's recently rolled out the in-store menu system, like with the digital display boards. Mm-hmm. That's all written in Polymer. And it's, you know, but like there needs to be a like big Polymer project or big web component project that people are like, oh yeah, this is safe to use. You know, again, that hive mind, I think we were talking about in the last episode, you know, we exist on such a hive mind on things. You know, I think, you know, for better or for worse, there needs to be a big project that uses it before people will be like, yeah, I'll use it. So,
yeah. JavaScript, it seems like it addresses the things that people need. I can imagine native JavaScript going in a direction that's like, oh, I see, you need help with DOM management stuff. You need, you know, there needs to be a way that, like, when you change things, that things automatically happen for you in the browser. Whatever way that is, we're going to start helping you there. And look at how many people reach to other projects to help with this, like, global state management thing. I wonder if we could make that a more powerful native concept in JavaScript. Of course that's going to happen.
Yeah.
It'll take forever, but it will.
Yeah, I mean, if the template element had loops and if statements, just a little bit of logic, you know, that seems just very basic. I think that would be a huge boon for web components. But then kind of that idea of DOM management or Redux, just that like a standardized flow for this component up, this piece I re-render based on this change. I think that'll be a huge addition to the HTML suite.
That was quite the aside there. I just figured we'd do it. It's been on the mind.
I should post my thing. I went deep, man. I just started just kind of going through and, you know, kind of jotting down experience, you know, because, you know, it's an interesting world. But yeah, I'm excited about it. I want to kind of practice it myself first, you know, but then pass it on to my clients. That's kind of my goal.
I like an interesting like a low stakes version is the pattern library thing. Mm-hmm. And so to just, because a lot of people build a pattern library that's not their production app, you know, it's related to, might use some of the same assets, but isn't as mission critical as the rest of the app. And I think a web components based pattern library is compelling.
Yeah. I mean, why not? You know, it's kind of works, you know, and then you don't need to know like JavaScript, React, Webpack, all that stuff, you know, just to make a website. You just have to know how to make tiny HTML files to make a style guide that also runs on the live site. So
indeed.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you by Rollbar. That's rollbar.com. It's full stack error monitoring for your web app. It's like ridiculously easy to install and works in all kinds of major languages and frameworks and just everything. A JavaScript app with any framework, Python, Ruby, PHP, Java.net, iOS stuff, WordPress, Rails, whatever. Whatever, you install it in there, and it captures and tracks the errors that happen. I'm saying there's about 100% chance that your app is throwing errors of some kind, probably errors that users are seeing too. How do you know that that's happening? Where do they go? Do you have it set up to like email yourself or whatever? We've all done that to some degree. No, you need to be tracking them for real. You need to know how often they're happening. It'd be nice to look at a stack trace. It'd be looked at when it happened. And so Rollbar is that. It's like a dashboard for all the errors that your app is throwing. And you can set up notifications for them. Like, send it to me, you know, like I only want one email, not 1,000 emails when this happens. Or, you know, email me again if the severity is higher or whatever, how critical it is. all kinds of stuff like that. It's just vital stuff that you have to have on your web app. So you know, it's and there's just a million more features than that. That's just the base level stuff. It's just my pitch to get you to start using error tracking software like Rollbar in your app, because it's just good for you. It's like high fiber cereal for your web app. That's rollbar.com. Thanks again.
All right. Hey, we are like half hour into our hard stop episode. Should we get some questions? Because we got an anonymous one here from No Names Please, who I really wanted to do an all anonymous show, Chris. So if you got really deep, like
I used to be like, why? Like we're all friends here, but now I don't care. The question is the interesting part. So if anybody out there has an anonymous question, feel free to send it in.
Send in some really dark anonymous questions. We'll try to do it all anonymous. I was contracted with a firm to do the front end work on a project that went sideways. There are a number of reasons for this, but none related to my work. I'm considering getting professional liability insurance in case the client decides to bring a lawsuit against the agency. Jeez. I don't think this will happen, but I'm interested in to hear your thoughts, recommendations, and experiences with this type of insurance. Do you know of anyone that has ever needed it? I've considered getting this type of insurance in the past, but never had to go through with it because I figured my contracts and LLC status provided me with enough protection. Also, is there an AIGA equivalent for web developer professionals? Web professionals, I've never heard of one. Anyone speak about one? And the ones I find when searching the web don't seem very active. If there's a popular, respected association, do you have any theories as to the reason, and do you think the industry could benefit from having one? I bring this up because I've heard of trade association members receiving special rates for insurance.
Oh, I see.
That's sort of...
Does the AIGA just not deal with web at all? Or can you...
I think you could be AIGA, but I'm not sure. I think it's more geared in a different direction.
So No Names Please says... Not only are they probably not getting paid for this job, but they might get sued too.
Yeah.
Just for building the website. Mm-hmm. That seems wild. And so presumably the website did something illegal, or maybe it was slanderous or something, like something that the client did, somebody didn't like. Mm-hmm. And now because they literally did work on it, like you drove the getaway car, you're getting trouble.
You drove the getaway car. Is this a Baby Driver reference? Are we doing Baby Driver, the website?
I do wear headphones when I code.
Hey, exactly.
I don't. But.
Okay. So you're an L. It said he mentioned he is an LLC, which is good because if they try to sue you, your LLC basically says, sorry, we're bankrupt and closed, we're gone, bye. That I'm not a lawyer, so don't listen to me. But so I think that's good. That's a good shield around you and whatever. But they could seize like your assets that your company bought, which would be like your computer and stuff like that, which is kind of no bueno. There's this thing called profits and loss insurance. I don't know if you're familiar with it, Chris.
I'm not.
But it's for these kind of screw-ups. And I think we had to get it at Paravel as a part of like a contract. Like we need something like $2 million in profit and loss. So it's kind of, that's a lot. But I think, you know, I could be wrong, but you'll have to talk, you know, your mileage may vary, but I think it's like $2,000-something a year or something, all said and done. It could be way more or way less. I'm not, but I think it's in that ballpark.
Okay.
So, you know, it's not cheap if you're like yourself, but you know, that will protect you against kind of major mess ups. I do have a friend, who was working on a site, you know, had all these decisions documented through Basecamp, you know, working with this client. They're going to launch and the person doesn't like the website, decides they don't like the website. Very litigious person, threatens to sue. And that, so in, you know, it was, I'm making up numbers here, but it was like a $10,000 job and a like $200,000 lawsuit or something like that for like damages and whatever. So, it's important to have this stuff, you know, in like, in kind of these, like,
yeah, I mean, it just sucks, you know. But I think all professions face it. Doctors have insurance, right? In case they get screwed. They can't, you didn't become a doctor only to lose your entire thing based on one client, you know, like you need to, I mean, maybe you'll lose your job or something, but you can't lose your house just because you left a sponge inside somebody or whatever.
Yeah. Did I call it profit and loss insurance? That is not what it is. It's called errors and omissions. Sorry. I want to clarify that if I said it wrong. So yeah, you need something for these errors and omissions that could come up, you know, and you do kind of need to have a lawyer if you're going to be freelance, you know, because you never know who's going to just show up, you know, kind of go wild on you and start suing you, and you need contracts and you need like negotiations.
Yeah.
Like,
I wonder if you can handle this from the get go. Can you, you know, cause everybody it has that advice, right? You have your client sign something before you start. And a lot of that is that you're going to pay me. So at the end of it, you get paid. I wonder if you can put language in there that's like, hey, listen, you're going to okay everything. You're going to be the person who decides when this thing goes live. But when you do that, you waive your right to sue me also, or something like that. Or maybe you just waive your right to sue me, period, because screw that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what I'm not a lawyer. I don't know how you, like, get around these things, but I think it was kind of this, you know, they did a website for somebody who just was litigious and knew how to sue people for whatever reason they wanted, you know, and even though it was like, you signed off on all these decisions, you know, like we did what you said, but he was, you know, I think the contract or whatever was set up for, you're supposed to make me a website. And then he felt like he didn't have a website, you know? So, that's just a bummer. It's a terrible situation. Tricky.
Like my freaking neighbors got some like worked on their house, mm-hmm. and they went big, you know. This is a huge job, tons of work, and had this great relationship. I look at the post now, I'm like, wow, that's amazing, it looks great. But there's like one problem, there's some kind of like, there's a hole here and it leaks some water. So that's not what it was, but it was something like that. And you know, and they're not entirely happy with the people who did the work's response to this, and are they going to fix it for free? Are they not going to fix it for free? How quickly are they going to fix it? What are they going to be responsible for? To the point where it's like, well, I think lawyers are going to get involved now. And then it's like, I don't know whose side I'm on. I have no idea what's happening here. But it's just amazing that, you know, you're trying to, you know, on one hand, you're just wanting to get some work done and wanting to not have my house destroyed. And on the other hand, I'm just trying to run a business here, doing some contracting work and not lose my house and home over it, trying to run a successful business. Like everybody on people on both sides are like, you know, oh my God, what a horrible situation.
Yeah. I'm again not a lawyer, but I think if you're a subcontractor, you're kind of protected, you know, or like it shouldn't fall on you, you know, like you weren't the main
right
negotiator.
That's why some people, you know, go, so. That's why you go work at, you know, you work at the bank, because you don't want to own the bank, because then you're
and you got all the problems of owning the bank. So I, you know, like this, you know, do they, you know, your neighbor's situation, they're probably going to sue the general contractor who set up who did the work, not the guy who installed the drywall. You know what I mean? So, or whatever. So hopefully that helps. But I would definitely get some insurance, talk to somebody. You probably don't need $2 million. That's was just required for us, for our client. So sure. I think that's something you'll want to do.
Good luck there for sure.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you by GitKraken, like G-I-T, get it? Like the version control software, Git, the thing that we all love and live in every day. They say, release the Kraken. GitKraken is the most popular Git GUI client on Windows, Mac, and Linux. So it's on all three platforms. If your team is diverse that way, you can at least still all use the Git client. GUI, like, it's software. You open it up. It's visual. I mean, that's the whole point of it, is that it's a GUI for managing your Git repos, which is fantastic. It looks beautiful. It's some of the best programmers I know, you know, who use Git on the command line, no strangers to the command line, fine, but prefer to use a GUI client because there's just a lot going on in Git that makes sense to visualize. Like, oh, what branches do I have open? Here are all the branches. Like, oh, I need to merge this one to this one. Let me just drag and drop to do that. Oh, I need to rebase it. Why don't I just click this button? And it just kind of makes sense as a GUI, and it's nice that GitKraken exists to do that for us. It's super integrated with, and of course it is, you know, GitHub, Bitbucket, and GitLab. So it's like you get your credentials in there, and then you can be making new repos, and the stuff that you yank has all your right permissions, all that stuff. It's just nicely integrated with those, which is fantastic. Oh yeah, it's also free for non-commercial use, so that's pretty cool. As soon as you need to use it for commercial use, it's very affordable. You can also save $10 by using coupon code SHOPTALK. So go to GitKraken, GitKraken.com/ShopTalkShow and grab GitKraken. And if you use it for commercial use, use that coupon code SHOPTALK for $10 off.
We have some more questions we can do here, I think. Yeah. Stina Kvarnström, you do it.
All right, here we go. Oh, it's an audio question.
No, you got to do the last name.
Oh, Kvarnström.
Okay.
Kvarnström.
Starts with a Q.
Very cool. Best name so far on the Shop Talk Show. You get 100 Shop Talk Show points.
There's an umlaut on the O.
See? Yeah, it's strong. It's very strong.
This is very strong.
Hello. Right now, in my spare time, I'm organizing a course together with a non-profit organization called Pink Programming, and we're going to teach front-end web development to women and help more of us become web developers. I'm going to teach JavaScript from the very beginning up to getting to know some frameworks and how the profession works. And my question is this: what do you think is important to teach when it comes to JavaScript and front-end development? Is there something you wish you'd understood earlier, or something that you think is really important? Some programming concept, or more broad, like some mindset or way to think about code and work with code, and something you can't just Google? It would be so great to get some input on this, and thank you from Stina in Sweden.
So Pink Programming in Sweden. What's the, what do you think? What, like, how do you go about it? I'll tell you, I have a little bit of experience in sitting in on a class where somebody else was teaching JavaScript from the beginning, and I was just watching their course unfold, and it was very interesting. They did a few things that I thought were particularly interesting. I mean, the goal was to get in the browser and to make a website that uses some JavaScript and stuff, but they did not start there. They started with Node.js. It's kind of cool because you can do some JavaScript fundamental stuff just right on the command line and not like start with the DOM and stuff like that. So it's just like they already knew the command line because the course itself started with teaching the kids some Git. And they weren't all kids. I just say kids, students. Git, because the course material was in Git and stuff, and it's an important concept to learn anyway. Why not be the first thing you teach them a little bit of Git, some command line like Git pull repo or whatever, because you just need a few command lines and it's like, oh wow, holy crap, some files have appeared on my system and all that. So now they're already in the command line. You've already had them install Node because, well, that takes 1 second anyway, right? You go and npm install whatever, or maybe Node's already installed, or it's just a simple installable, however Node works. I don't even remember anymore. I think it's an installable, like for the very first time you install it, right? Mm-hmm. Now you're already on the command line. You can type Node and then like you know, app.js or whatever, and you have this file open in your you've had them download Sublime or Atom or what's the— we should almost do a whole show on the new Microsoft editor.
Code.
Literally every single person at CodePen has switched to it, except for me now, because I just need a little time to get to it.
I use it. It's great.
Even Tim Savitt, our Vim guys, all over. Because apparently you just turn on Vim in it, and you got Vim in there, too. Anyway, fascinating. It's amazing. You love it, too. Everybody loves it. So you get and it's free, right? So you get some editor like that and you have them teach something like whatever console.log 2+2 and they see it right on their command line. And then they're
they're writing JavaScript, they're learning JavaScript, they're learning this programming language, not in the browser, but just like as a language, you know? Mm-hmm. And they're comfortable with it because it's they're already on the command line because of the Git stuff anyway. I thought that was fascinating. And then you move, and then you're like, see that file you wrote, app.js? That works in the browser too. Woo, boom, boom. Cool stuff.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, I love that you're doing this, Stina. I think this is great, getting more people into web development. I would encourage you to, I know some women who have done Girl Develop It here in the States. Let's see, Jen Lucas, Elise Holiday. These are all people who have been on the show. Sam Kapila, Sophie Shepherd. These, reach out to some of these women. Hit me up on Twitter. I can introduce, but I think there's different approaches, different mindsets. Some people really are like they're programmatic. Like they want to like understand how these everything tinkers and stuff like that. There maybe people are kind of like, well, I'd rather like learn that at the end. So you're gonna maybe have to like, you know, kind of figure out who wants to learn what and where, who kind of this comes naturally to, who kind of it doesn't come naturally to. I think that's just people in general. But yeah, I think, you know, start, just get people into it. I think what's like what you're saying, Chris, is you can use JavaScript in the browser. So like just open up DevTools and start hacking a page, you know, query select or something and change it. You know, I think it back to maybe we talked about in the last show, but you know, how do I get my daughter into stuff, right? Or CSS, I believe it was. You know, I think part of it is, you know, you find those little things that produce mm-hmm. instant gratification. And I think that's going to be the biggest.
I love that. Yes.
Like do the things that produce the instant gratification and then they'll be way more hooked to learn all the.
It's that, and it's like a feeling of power was good to me too. Not in like a power hungry, like weirdo kind of way, but like I made a thing that now exists on the real internet. Because everybody knows, everybody coming into this class is going to know how a web browser works. And you go to a URL and it comes up, you know? Mm-hmm. And then to teach you that that's what you're learning how to do, but right away, like, you know, you can do it.
You can like, send
I would
it
even maybe even have them all buy a, as part of the, yeah, that day. Have them all buy a domain name. How cool would that be? I know that's, you might want to help them through it. And I know that's a little weird because it's, I don't know, it's like, you know, you got to pick the right thing and they have to have a credit card and, you know, it might renew on them. And you might have to like to have a little education around what it means to own a domain name. But I would think that would be really neat. Like have everybody pick out a domain name. And then by the end of this class, you know, have them put something up on it, you know, that's just kind of fun or a result of their learning. And because that could feel so powerful. Yeah, you could send that to your parents. You could send it to your friend. You can, you know, wait for it to show up in Google search results. And you're like, you're it. You're a web designer now.
Yeah. I think the thing of... Yeah, like the reason I got into websites was like the thrill of self-publishing. And I don't think, you know, you can't do that with an app or whatever. You can maybe like boot it to your phone or something like that. But like, it's just on my phone, you know, but like with a website, oh, it's up everywhere. Anyone can get to it the second you like hit save or FTP.
That'll appeal to a good chunk of people. I mean, I'm sure there's some, everybody's different. So everybody resonates with different things, but that'll hit home with a good chunk of people.
Yeah. I think there's like this, a level, just find little things that produce instant gratification. And then that will maybe get people more excited to kind of keep going and doing more. So, JavaScript, you know, I don't know. It's so tough because there's different kinds of people, but I think just choose something basic, you know, just like, here's how you select an element. Here's how you change it. Here's how, you know, you select a bunch of elements and loop through them and then change all
that's
of them.
That's good. I might go with the click being a
click event. Yeah.
Being a good one
on click, do something. Turn it upside down.
I think in the last episode, you mentioned something about, you know, because we had that PowerPoint the girl was that was resonating with her, and dad wanted to do the, you know, make CSS click. Mm-hmm. Same kind of thing. You mentioned how an animation might be particularly compelling. Mm-hmm. That, yeah, some kind of transition or animation on that click. Woohoo! That could do it.
Yeah, and if these ladies have already learned CSS like fundamentals, like it's very cool to like add a class to an element and see it just change or show hide or whatever, you know, there's a lot you can do there. So, yeah. So I think that's good. I think that's a good thing to do. So hopefully that helps you, Stina. Thank you for sending in your question. We really appreciate it. Also love the internationalness and anonymity of our listeners, Chris. But do you think we should wrap it up here? Is it?
Well, it's a hard stop edition, but we might have like 2 minutes. So maybe let's do this last one and, okay, and like one. Rapid fire. Yeah.
All right, here we go. Last one. Alex L. writes in, hey, I've been a front-end developer for roughly a year now. I've been extremely fortunate to receive such a steady rate of clients and started my business, and I take pride in my work. Recently, I discovered that somebody had copied my code and used it for their website. I completely understand referring to other designers' code and examples for inspiration, but this individual literally copied and pasted my code, icons, even images. In fact, he didn't even think to change the email in the contact form. Has this ever happened to either of you? If so, what actions did you take? Additionally, would you consider the line? Where would you consider the line when it comes to utilizing the code of other designers?
My super quick answer is that just screw, like, if maybe if it's possible to, and you know who they are and you know that they're trying to have a public presence too, that a name and shame kind of thing is appropriate here. Like, no, screw you. You know, if you have a Twitter account or whatever, I'm going to show the world on Twitter what a dickball you are. And and here you go. Because that is after you've individually contacted them. I should say that first. Like, maybe they just didn't know. If you know how to get in contact with them, say, hey, you stole my work. It's absolutely uncool. You don't have my permission to do it. Please take it down right away. If they don't do that, often I find that for whatever reason, they're usually a dick back. Not usually, but like that, it's regular that they're like, I can do whatever I want. Okay, now it's name and shame time. I'm going to do that. I hate to advocate for stuff like that, but, you know, just sometimes you got to fight back a little bit here. It's just, maybe that's just the way I am, but it's the way I am, damn it. And then the second part is, if nothing, you know, like, don't hire a lawyer. Like, for the large part, who cares? They're not going to take your design and be more successful with it than you are. It's just not going to happen. In the grand scheme of things, it doesn't matter that much. The copies are always just a little worse, and just, it won't be maintained, and it's just a little gross, and they're just a gross person anyway. They're destined for a life that's not as fulfilling as yours as a non-thief. So enjoy your better life.
Yeah, you know, in some ways, this is a rite of passage
that you've encountered. Yeah, sure.
We had people like copy our stuff kind of somewhat regularly. So I there is like this line of influencing versus stealing, but it appears they just stole it. I think I agree. I'd bring it up one-on-one. If that doesn't work, you know, like have one of your friends email too and be like, hey, it looks like you stole this from this guy.
Hey, that's like a clever idea.
You know, and then kind of like starting to put the heat on, you know, and then if they're still like kind of jerks about it, or, you know, they, then you basically just like say like, hey, this guy out here stole my design. Like, just don't whine about it or what. You're probably upset, like, you know, never tweet upset, but, you know, just make sure you're just kind of level-headed about it, like this is pretty bogus, you know. I think that's okay to do, you know, but don't, like, I think just make it, document that fact. But clearly, like, if they copied and pasted your code, like just stole your website, they might have been under the direction of their client. Like, we want this website, you know, which is terrible, but
you don't know people's circumstances, meaning the individual reach out is so vital here.
Yeah. I mean, I've been in meetings where people are like, how about we just copy, you know, this line of code or this thing. And you're just like, no, we'll just make our own, you know, but they really just wanted to copy because they thought, oh, that's the quickest way to get something done. But if they are copying an image, or copying your code and stealing it, you know, they don't know how to make a website, you know, so they're not going to be successful. Like they just only know how to copy. So, they're probably gonna like whatever lose their shirt on this, so it's probably not worth it. If they are hot linking your images, there are some tricks to do where you can send them you know, if the request comes from this website, you can use some magic to send some salacious images back. I think that's maybe a nuclear threat, but you know, hey, it's if they're hot linking your stuff, why not? I don't know. Just keep them on their toes, you know, because if you want that client that he made, you know, or that website to change real fast, the best way to do that is awful images on their homepage. So there you go. So,
oh, yeah, the old hot linkerino there.
Yeah. You just hijack the hot link. It'll change pretty quickly after that. So, all right. Well, you know, hey, you got the power. It's the pacifist approach.
I love stuff like that. Yeah, sure. Yeah, cool.
It's, you know, hey,
I wouldn't call it passive aggressive. It's maybe aggressive.
It's aggressive, but it's also within your rights, I guess, you know, like mm-hmm. They chose to hot link. They ran the risk. So, anyway, hopefully that helps you. We are not a legal podcast, but do we like to try to field those questions. So thank you all for writing in. And be sure to star heart favorite this up in your podcatcher of choice. That's how people find out about the show. Tweet about it or follow us on Twitter at shoptalkshow.com. At shoptalkshow. I'm not doing good, Chris. We got to wrap this up. Hard stop. If you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs. Get a brand new one. And Chris, do you have anything else you'd like to say?
That's it, sir. shoptalkshow.com.